Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
There are so many topics covered in this episode that stretch from the continued lack of understanding regarding neurodiversity in sport, but also in everyday life. A term I know from my work in the sustainability field known as greenwashing, where organizations paint their websites green, take a few photos of diverse-looking people, and employ a sustainability manager so that they can avoid actually changing the way they do things, also finds expression in other areas, notably diversity washing. Delay tactics are nothing new. Humans are naturally prone to repetition. That's probably why we usually do the same kinds of activities and why we don't do something completely random day after day. However, to face a developing social need to accept diversity, understand it, and then adopt methods to improve working methods and structures requires a genuine commitment to change. That genuine commitment is missing in many areas of structural public and private business. It's not enough to publicly accept the need to change and then conduct research into how that change can be justifiably slowed down to squeeze every last cent or penny out of the status quo. People think differently on things, but people also think in different ways, differently. We can't create a neurological mold and force everyone to comply. What needs to be done is create working environments that are better suited to diversity rather than uniformity. It's not about making exceptions, it's about acceptance. Thank you, Kara and Mikey, for coming to talk with me about these things. Enjoy.
Jepek kuduelo mabiro etu under mic. Dung parodit kod jok mawo yetu under mic. Seche tim sudbuta wawinji etu under mic. Wola wachokre wabed piny biwawinje erochako dumomit ndi podcast makende.
Episode number 4 with Kara and Mikey, which is a bit of a surprise, actually. But before I say why it's a surprise, I should say hello. How are you?
Yeah, we're good. Is it already episode 4? I didn't realise it.
Yeah, we did quite a few while
Yeah. No, good. How are you?
Yeah, good. I say it's a bit of a surprise, but I actually feel like we've had more episodes because the work that you do pops up in so many different sort of on platforms and email and neurodiverse sport and Kara and this and Mikey's done that. And so I feel like we've actually spoken about 100 times over the last few weeks, but that's not the case.
Yeah, so. I know. But I also follow your stuff as well. So I don't know when you, I feel like we're friends.
Yeah.
So when you're friends,
oh no,
like you talk all the time.
Yeah. It's, I think of social media where you feel you know someone's complete life nowadays, don't you, without actually speaking to them or seeing them.
My highlight was when a friend of yours remade your logo, and it looks really good now. Because at one point, I was going to do it for you.
I'm so happy you brought that up, because I've actually put that into my notes to bring it up, but you presented that in such a nice way. The way that I remember it is that you sent me a message, I think it was on LinkedIn, and you said, "Oh, Zach, I'm so happy you've changed your logo because it was absolute pants." So that's the way I remember it. And you said you were about to do a design for me. So, yeah, that was my friend Nassos, by the way. So
sorry, plugged in. Blunt.
No, I thought it was so amusing because you're probably right. It was just a photo of a few bald men standing in front of a basket. So,
it didn't reflect all the hard work and the professionalism that you put in.
But the rebrand is positive, so
yeah,
it's good.
Definitely. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And yeah, it's so nice that people think about this in the way that you do. So great. Okay. For talking of professionalism, you guys have, yeah, I don't know what it is, where you get your sort of endless amounts of energy from, but you're just like every week almost there's boom, boom, boom. Kara's been invited to do this. Mikey's racing that. You're doing this. You're doing that. And it's like, my word. I mean,
like, honestly, if you saw me day to day, you would believe it. Like, this morning, to be fair, this morning was an unusual case because yesterday I hate filming. So I put off like three bits of filming I had to do till the last minute. So today it had to be in. So I did it yesterday. And I also obviously had, you know, those, what are they called? Those hoop like lights that make you look good.
Ring light.
A ring light. They really mess with my eyes. Like, I have really sensitive eyes, so they literally make me feel sick. So I was so tired by the end of it. And then I just wasn't thinking rationally because it had, like I said, it just destroys my brain. And then I proceeded to ignore my note to self that said, you know, stop working at 5 p.m. I worked until midnight. And then this morning I just couldn't. Well, I probably could have pulled myself out of bed, but I was like, you are on the edge of burnout. You need to kind of stay laid down in the dark for a bit longer. So I had a really unproductive morning this morning. But I guess I've kind of learned that over my life. You can't keep taking. Without giving back. But yeah, a lot of hard work and discomfort comes with being this seemingly productive. I'm not always productive. It comes and goes. And I look at other people on social media and think, oh my God, how do they have so much energy? So I kind of feel bad that I'm making other people feel like that, because that's rubbish. I don't always have a lot of energy.
Well, the output is insanely good from the both of you, I can only imagine. I'm on a side note, I'm sort of getting into a lot more of my sort of yoga theory and learning a lot about these things. And one of the principles that came out quite strongly was how in the misinterpretation of Western yoga or westernized versions of yoga, we don't emphasize enough the need for rest and rehabilitation. Yeah. And the body is always crying out for it, and the mind as well.
Yeah.
But that's not a part of our psyche in the West. We always have to be doing things. And we don't, do we?
Yeah. No, I agree. I typically chuck like 20 minutes of yoga in, which is not the correct type of yoga. But there is like some that I follow, and it's interesting noticing the difference between different instructors and stuff. I mean, for me, it's just glorified stretching and stuff. For me, the way I use it is a bit of glorified stretching, but I definitely see the benefit of all the breathing exercises, the meditation, all those other elements which aren't included in most yoga classes, sort of thing.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
And when I actually give myself an hour or a couple hours to do a session, it's definitely kind of you feel so much more centered as a whole, and you've taken that time, and it's important to give yourself that extra little bit of time to find yourself and center yourself and step away from whatever you're doing to be that productive person and not always on the go, always trying to produce something.
I think everyone would benefit from having like a sensory deprivation pod in their house. Like, it wouldn't have to be big, but I think that's half of why if I try and do yoga, I'm still being distracted by the lights, the noise, my thoughts. that sometimes you need to be forced. Maybe I should do yoga blindfolded or something.
When I was flying back from somewhere this year, we were a bit early and I was in the departures hall and it was really bustling and stuff. And there was these, in the corner, just shoved away, there was these 8 kind of rent a bed pods sort of thing.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, that's tempting. I could just go switch. You're right in the middle of like this crazy busy place. But I was like, oh, I wouldn't mind just lying down in the middle of there. But yeah.
But you didn't, did you, I guess?
I didn't because I was with other people and they wanted to do something else. And,
Yeah, I appreciate your company, but I'm slipping into a pod on my own.
And I think it was like, and also when you kind of, when you look and it's like €20 to lie down somewhere, you kind of like, should be included on national health systems, but you know.
National Health Service is an interesting debate, but we've actually never talked politics, so maybe that's probably a good thing. We should keep away from that. Today we might sort of.
Yeah, I feel like the topics that you suggested are a little bit political.
I'm sorry, but it's political in a direct relationship with what you do. So, hopefully that's. Shouldn't be too bad then. But again, before we get there, what's new is what I've listed for sort of point number one. Can you talk a bit more again about your blog? Because I think the last time we spoke about your blog, it was some time ago, and there may be people who listen who haven't heard you before, and they should actually know about your blog.
So I guess the blog, it's on our website, and we've also got social media, so Instagram and LinkedIn. I'd say there's more stuff on Instagram. It's really a place where I tell or other people tell stories about their experience of neurodivergence in sport. And the really important thing for me is that even when I tell somebody's story, is their story and their perspective, their barriers, their ability to overcome them or not. So I really try and get that across and try and make it as honest as possible and engaging as possible so that people see the reality of the situation and they can learn from every single story in an interesting and engaging way. And the more stories that are put on the blog, the more it becomes representative of reality in the overall context, because what I'm trying to get across is that every single person is different, whether or not they have the same diagnosis, the same label, they'll experience that differently. So it's kind of like a learning piece in its entirety as well. And then, you know, if you want to learn a bit more, you there's so much to read and look at now. But also, if you're coming in there wanting to know something specific, like wanting to find other athletes who are autistic or have dyslexia, dyspraxia, ADHD, you can kind of search that and find people so that you don't feel as alone. It was my way of addressing the distinct lack of role models, community support immediately, because obviously there's like lots going on in the background with neurodiverse sport. There's lots we're trying to do and pulling the strings and working with organizations and educating teams, but that's slow and you can't control it. But what I can control, and that's why I say it's like the backbone of what we do, is just putting stories out there and making people feel less weird and less alone. There's not enough role models and there's not enough advice out there for people who are neurodivergent, and so especially in sport. So it's providing that, but it's not my opinion. It's fact. It's people's experiences, and you can't argue with that. And I think that's the beauty of it.
Yeah, it's just a really useful resource to, like, if you want something to relate to or kind of find out how people have overcome their own hurdles and everything, it's really useful. And the more we do, the more stories we get, the more of a bank of kind of information and stories we make, the better.
Yeah, I over the years that I've worked with people either teaching English or in workshops or whatever, what I've always tried to do is listen. And the best thing about my, I think, this ability that I have to listen and recall people's stories is that when I'm when I encounter people in the future and they bring up similar topics, somehow this these memories sort of come flooding back and I can retell these stories. So you know, it's not, I tell them this isn't my personal experience, but these are the stories of people who have experienced these things. Does that story help you as well? And people immediately feel more relaxed because they know, oh, there is somebody that's experienced this. This is something that's out there. And it really is comforting in many ways, as you say.
It's so true. Like the best messages I get, like when I'm feeling incredibly burnt out, which unfortunately is quite often at the moment, and I'm feeling like depressed because I have no dopamine left in my brain, and I'm so tired. Like looking at those messages that people send, is it makes it all worth it. So, you know, people will just drop a message, take, and I'm sure there are a lot of people who don't even think to message and still feel this way, but some people are compelled to drop a message on Instagram or LinkedIn or the website, you know, and say, thank you so much for what you're doing. Like it means a lot to me or my child, or it's taught me this or that. And a lot of it is, it's just reassured me. Like, I feel like, yeah, like I said, I feel less alone. And I've really resonated with what you said or what you've written about this athlete or something like that. And I think because neurodivergence is not talked about, so people generally try to kind of hide their differences. You could be stood next to someone who is neurodivergent and you yourself could be neurodivergent and you might not know it because you're both kind of masking and acting as normal as you possibly can because you want to be socially accepted. But that in itself is incredibly isolating because you know that you're different and you don't see anyone else like you. And especially when that comes with difficulties that might not be innate to the condition, they might be socially constructed barriers, but they're still difficulties. It's really, really hard. I read a really, really stark statistic the other day. I feel like this is the kind of information that you're going to go and look up now. But average life expectancy for autistic people without intellectual disability is 20 years less than the average population in its entirety. For autistic people with intellectual disability, it's, I think, 39 years old. And that's because I think that group tend to also have comorbid conditions such as epilepsy. But for the people without intellectual disability who don't necessarily have comorbid conditions, the second leading cause of death is suicide. And that, to me, speaks volumes to how people are feeling and made to feel. And it was exactly the information I needed to hear at the time because I was starting to get really burnt out and then it really lit a fire in me. But yeah, it's serious.
Yeah, and what's striking is that so much of this information has taken so much time to come out, as in it's quite common to hear about, for example, that the famous 27 Club with all of these artists and singers and actors and so on. But we tend not to hear about that in, let's say, athletes beyond their retirement, as in once an athlete sort of falls off that sort of professional participation in sport. And if it's not like an A-list athlete in football or something, you know, people don't follow or don't pursue that. What happens to that person? So yeah, that's a very troubling statistic, isn't it? 39 to 53 years old, that's nothing.
How did you know that? How did you make that calculation then? It was 53. You must know off the top of your head the average life expectancy. You're just a well of information.
I think I just sometimes get lucky. Another thing, though, because you also do, you since the blog, you've developed lots and lots of connections with other organizations. But on top of that, I think something that you did recently, or maybe you've done quite often, but I don't know about, but together, was a workshop. You went to, you both delivered a workshop together. Is that true?
Yeah, we started to do more kind of in-person events and stuff. So there's been a few workshops we've been doing with Olympic teams and things like that. And then we've also had a couple of sort of like show events sort of thing where we've taken a stand just to sort of talk to people and kind of tell them what we're doing, see if anyone else is sort of interesting and like what they're doing in their space and stuff. So yeah, we started to move from just a virtual presence to in-life presence, which has been, it's quite rewarding when you actually get out there and get everything sorted. And yeah, actually having real life conversations, it's really interesting, even for us who kind of struggle with conversations sometimes. But yeah,
in real life.
Yeah, and there's a good story about the stress of setting up our display board the night before, getting that delivered last minute, and small argument.
There's a pattern that's coming up with me.
a small argument that happened in our kitchen trying to set it up. But yeah.
I need the adrenaline of last minute. I think I also have a lot on, so you know, other things have to take priority. But
to be fair, I was in charge of ordering it, and it did only come last minute.
Yeah. Okay.
But you hadn't opened it until about 6 p.m.
Yeah. True.
Yeah. I feel that a secondary blog of relationship management is also somewhere planned in the future. But I mean, have you considered doing workshops for sectors outside of? I know you're both, you know, sports people, but have you also considered doing these kinds of workshops for high pressure positions in or organizations or companies in other sectors like business and so on?
We have a little bit. So Cara did one herself for a bank, and it went down really well and was really well received. I think it's time and resource, although kind of obviously it funds well and helps, that funding then helps the cause. It's how much time you put into
advertising,
not,
really,
yeah, not necessarily doing them. It's the focus of advertising for it, and
if they come, we'll do them.
Yeah, I think it's
that, like, tends to be the kind of rule. But like, I wouldn't at the moment. I haven't gone out of my way, or we haven't gone out of our way to advertise to corporations because that in itself takes a day or two to do, and you know you have to push it. But through kind of natural osmosis people have kind of come our way anyway, and then yeah, we generally don't turn things down at the moment.
Yeah, so it's definitely something we do, but it's more the getting around to advertising it and kind of what platform you advertise it and everything as opposed to anything else at the moment. And yeah.
And it's also, I mean, okay, at the bank, it was Cara alone, but I mean, is it something that you'd like to do more together or individually, or does it not really matter?
So that was a talk, and that was more about my story to the EDI network. But we do the workshops together.
We do the workshops together. It depends, because we're sort of really quite open to whoever we're working with, like whatever their needs are, and we'll suggest certain things or workshops. But you know, if they say we've got however many hundred people and they just want to talk sort of thing, and that's the sort of best way of doing it, then that's sort of the best way of doing it for some people. So where we're facilitating something and we've got a lot of control, we normally do bits together. because it's much easier to do a workshop as two of us sort of thing and share our knowledge base and relate and connect to people in different ways. But it's kind of down to the client as such, really, what they're after.
Yeah, I certainly don't love doing workshops on my own, because inevitably when you're educating around a subject that people don't know about, but also that is touchy, that you also have lived experience of, it can be really hard, and it's good to have somebody there with me. So unfortunately in sport, I think a lot of people attend a neurodiversity workshop wanting to find solutions to bad behavior, for instance, so like bad autistic behavior, or, you know, how do we solve ADHD? And that is not what I can provide, or we can provide. It's not what I want to provide either. And actually to confront those kind of misconceptions, and to say, have you considered what you're doing to disable people or enable them? That's challenging and that's hard. And so, yeah, like, that's why I don't really love doing it myself, because again, I've been in my career, it was suggested I was difficult. I had a management plan. Like, this is really triggering. I know I'm not a difficult person, and I know I don't need managing. It was just different. So yeah, there's a lot of like emotions tied up in it, I think.
In a different context, but somehow similar, I've got a student, and he was at a job interview, and the company, after a few minutes, they sort of set down some of the things that they would require from him, and he said, okay, stop, okay, I don't want the job, because quite clearly the problem here isn't the services that you want me to provide, the problem is your mindset, and that's what needs to be changed. So when you change your mindset, give me a call. And I thought, that's bloody cool. And I mean, he said he could do that because he's not worried about getting a job anytime soon, as in his situation is cool. So not everybody can do that, of course. But it does reiterate, I mean, what you're saying and what he says, completely different sectors. There is still a huge mindset issue to overcome within organizations, and sometimes as much as you speak to them, as much as these people nod and say yes, they still don't get it, do they?
They don't get it. I think it also is to do with the structure of big businesses, and there needs to be a solution to make the impersonal personal, because that's what it is. It's people are just, I don't want to say pencil pushing and box ticking, but ultimately they're kind of like, they don't really passionate about their jobs a lot of the time. They're just kind of following orders and not prepared to think outside of the box and see people as people. It's just, okay, this is the process I'm following. Do you fit into this mold? No, you don't. See ya. Whereas actually, like, you'd get a lot further if you thought for yourself, looked at the person, what can they give you, disregarded the tick boxes. And that's the luxury of probably being a smaller business and having a more personal approach. How do you ingrain that into big businesses? It would be hard, but I don't think it's impossible. You know, there's people flying into space. Like, we can probably figure that out at some point.
Mikey's nodding there. All right, Mikey, then. So I promised that I would accurately ask this question, so I had to confirm the country. You could tell how poor my knowledge of gravel bike racing is. But so you were at the World Championships in Italy. This was in September, was it?
Start of October.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Because it stays warmer in Italy, doesn't it, for longer?
Yeah.
First of all, I mean, do you need to have a personal invitation to this kind of event, or you need to qualify for it, right?
So it's like, you have to qualify for it, but there's a much like triathlon, people probably know quite well, there's an age group element and there's an elite element. So the elite element, you have to be selected by your national governing body to compete in the elite race. So already I'd qualified for the age group category through a couple of races through the year, but I applied to race the elite race through British Cycling and they gave me a place. So yeah. But yeah, it's good. But yeah.
So. Respect. Okay. Yeah, you always undersell yourself, don't you? You always, yeah, I kind of got a bit lucky. You know, I've never ridden a bike before, but there you are. but actually, you had quite a race. It was quite dramatic, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. The season as a whole was quite up and down. Like some good races, some bad races, some like bad luck, some good luck, and I suppose they're pretty summed up in that race as a whole sort of thing. I went off the start and I think about 10 seconds in, my brand new seat post on my brand new bike I was provided for the race slipped down. And so I was sat in a completely wrong position. And considering like obviously all the hours you spend on the bike, you get very used to your equipment and your setup and everything. Like, oh, this isn't very comfortable, but still got myself in quite a good position. But it kept slipping basically, and it looked like I was riding a rally chopper by about
I could just imagine
about half an hour in. So I kind of, and the race was still going pretty hot. So I took the decision to basically just take the 10 seconds to fix it. And luckily, kind of gravel racing, because of the sort of endurance nature of it, whereas if it's a road race, you have support cars and sport and teams and stuff, you go back to the car. But gravel racing, you don't have any of that. It's all, you're very much on your own. And so you carry like little Allen keys and bits and bobs with you. So I got my Allen key out, and as I was going along, I managed to loosen off the seat post, give it a knock, lift it up to what I felt was about right, tightened it well beyond the torque that it was supposed to be on probably to make sure it wasn't going down again. But in that kind of little bit of time, because the race was just so hard, I just briefly lost contact with the bunch I was on and ended up in a second group. And then cue a kind of frantic 2 hours, what it basically turned out to be, trying to chase back on. And in it's all those sort of like endurancey cycle, it's always all about kind of saving your matches. You kind of talk, you know, you've only got so many kind of efforts in you, and I used all those efforts quite early. So the last 50k or so was certainly a slog, but it was fine, it was good. And like I think it was a really kind of yeah, really positive end to the season after kind of, like I say, I had some good races. I also had some really good results in like races where, you know, you'd vomit through a rock field or something and think I should have broken something there. But luckily you haven't broken anything. So, yeah, rough and smooth with gravel cycling. Quite a lot of rough.
Okay, I always had visions of you as like a kind of Anakin Skywalker pod racing while you're sort of racing and you're fixing it as you're going along. But all right. But then at some point you talk about the season. I mean, do you also think about the next season? As in, are you going to give that another go?
Yeah. Like it's so funny. Kind of through the year, you kind of go, oh, do I want to do this anymore? This is like, it takes a lot of time, a lot of effort. And it's like almost the second you cross the line, you miss it already. And you're like, right, you're kind of getting on, trying to find sponsors, trying to find everyone, find funds basically to do it again. So yeah, I'm looking forward, planning the calendar already, some cool races coming up. And starting a little bit earlier, so starting in February this year, which is quite good. I look forward to it already. So
cool.
With my sort of ADHD brain, everyone comes off the seasons like puts their bike down and wants a month off the bike, and I think I had 2 days before I was doing something, and I officially called it, I had an off week as opposed to an off season, even though I did probably more in that off week than most people do in their first week back training. But that being said, the first 4 weeks back, as I say, have been really good and really positive. So I'm looking forward to the start of the year and kind of going in quite strong, hopefully.
You just gave Zach the perfect segue.
What was that?
You said, with my ADHD brain.
Before we do jump onto the next topic, then, yeah, it was interesting to read about some of the tribulations that you referred to. And also, I mean, when I saw your post come up on Instagram, it's like, straight away, there are so many other people commenting, offering support, and your teammates, and yeah, we're there for you, and all of this. And so you've got a really cool community around you too, so it's good to see.
No, I think that post, I kind of got, it was a little like a touch on sort of emotional, because it's like I say, it was end of the season, it's very reflective, and it kind of reflected back to kind of 12 months ago, 24 months ago and stuff. And it's when you kind of pause, going back to like when you stop and like your yoga and everything, actually when you take a pause and think about like where you are and where you've come from and stuff, it's easy to kind of be quite satisfied.
You also got a little bit of advice on your social regarding your social media, didn't you?
Yeah, and
from a friend.
Yeah, and a teammate's girlfriend was actually who's an influencer in her own right, basically gave me quite a lot of advice on bits and bobs to do, so that was good.
Very good. Okay, all right, cool. So then in that case, watch out for Mikey on social media, revolutionizing everything. Okay. Wow. Yeah, exactly. Cara, so as you said, politics. So I'd never even heard about the Disability Action Plan coming out, or this consultation document. So 2023 to 2024. Can you tell us about it? I mean, do you know anything about the background of it and so on?
Oh, I couldn't tell you about the background. We put together a response to the Get Active strategy first and the Disability Action Plan consultation document. And I think it was important to address both, because neurodiversity, neurodivergent people exist in every level of sport activity, physical activity, not just in disability sport. We responded as neurodiverse sport to the main points that they proposed. I guess primarily because, well, we want to light some fires and instigate change, but also because there was barely any mention of neurodiversity at all, which is pretty frustrating, considering there are so many neurodivergent people whose needs are not being met. And I think, considering it's kind of, to me, the golden thread that runs through all of these inclusion in sport initiatives, like all these communities that maybe aren't engaging with sport as much, I think there's a cultural element, but there's also the neurodivergent factor. And so, yeah, it's like, it's just one more of those things that we're trying to do to represent the community and to get the conversation started. And I've kind of tried to make sure that put it out on social media, on LinkedIn, and put it on the discussion forum of the website, and also put it on Instagram, which isn't probably the place that you would put it, but kind of made it into sort of our key responses, so it's nice and engaging and digestible. But it's all about it's all about not excluding people just because they don't, just like the whole concept in the way that I'm presenting the information, it's about not excluding people because they don't engage on certain platforms. Like, I want to make sure that everyone's being represented. And if I'm saying that I'm speaking on behalf of the neurodivergent community as the kind of first organization in sport to make that claim, well, I want to give people a chance to say what they want to say about it. So yeah, that's just, it's responding to what the conversation that's going on at a governmental level and the information that they're putting out.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if how many other people tend to engage in this kind of way. I think probably not many. Lots of people on social media probably read about, I don't know, a bill or something, and they send a couple of lines and they say, oh, this is bullshit or this is great or blah, blah, blah. But I mean, you've gone through it and you provided a pretty comprehensive list of responses.
Sorry, did you know that I'm autistic?
Yeah. And yeah. I still think
I really got hyper fixated and made sure I like really honed in on the details and just obsessed about it and made sure that every point was covered.
But I think that it's a good message though, actually, because like, so with social media giving everyone a voice, it's kind of you often don't actually direct it very well and kind of put in a little complaint about the bins on the community Facebook group isn't actually going to have any action on the bins. Like, if you actually want some action, then you have to do your research, take your time, and
but people don't know that
the right people.
But people don't know that, and that's totally fair enough. I wouldn't have known that until I had spoken to one of the other directors of Neurodiverse Sport, Charles Freeman.
Yeah.
Like, he's been so good in kind of teaching me the ways of the world in terms of bureaucracy. And I kind of feel, I almost feel like, I don't feel cheated, but I'm like, wow, there are so many people that just don't know the language and don't know the way things work. And that's why their voices aren't heard. And I think it's why I was so passionate about putting a really detailed and formal response in and then sharing it with the community. Because it's almost, it feels, I know this sounds really conspiratory, but it feels like these there's like languages created at the top and systems created so that people can't permeate them. And I think that's wrong. And so I'm trying to tread that line and delve into those systems, get the information, transform it, send it, you know, send it out to the masses and then get the response back. Because it's not fair that people are excluded from these conversations. That's my piece.
No, I completely agree. And just to go back to the point you said before, where, yeah, I know you have high functioning autism, and I still think you deserve to be complimented for the work and the effort that you've put in. And that's basically all I wanted to say. But yes, of course.
The thing is, I shouldn't stereotype like that. That's me making a joke. But, you know, some people, that's not how their autism presents. But I like to credit my autism because it doesn't get credited enough. It's always seen through a deficits lens, so you know, that's why I said that.
But
yeah,
of course. But again, the points that you make I think are also to be found in other areas where, I mean, language barriers are indeed limiting and restrictive to a number of different kinds of social groups, and this is one of those classic cases. And so therefore it's even more important that you've taken this step, and I still think it's you know, greatly courageous to be able to put it together and say to essentially a government or a political party or a civil service department, you know, hey, you guys, you're missing out, or you are excluding from your analysis a significant group of people who actually have a lot to contribute. And I think that's a very important step.
Yeah. And the thing is like, I just want to give you an example, but so 80% of autistic people are unemployed, and I'm self-employed right now. And I am, you know, you talked about my work output is huge, but I genuinely think, and you'll probably be like, no, you're not, but I genuinely think I would be difficult to employ because I do not fit into boxes. You would agree. I don't. And I ask questions, and I'm honest, I'm overall, I don't even think there is such a thing as overly honest, but like, I need to know the detail and I need to be involved in everything. And I'll tell you if something's not efficient or effective. I don't want to do it that way. If it's not efficient or effective, I don't want to do it. But like, those things are kind of good, but they don't fit into work environments as they are. And it is not surprising that 80% of autistic people are unemployed that you've got some really highly talented people whose capacity is totally wasted because they're kind of misunderstood or not supported. It's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And it reminds me, and I'm not going to sing my praises here, it's just something that I learned. But last week I did a workshop on sustainability with kids, and I had this like fantastic workshop all planned out. I've created it over ages, and such a significant plan, actions and stuff every day. But at a certain point, the kids said, no, we enjoy this task. We're going to keep doing this task. And these are like 8 to 13-year-old kids. And at that point, what do I do? Do I say to them, no, stop, you got to stick to my plan? Or do I just say, do you know what, you're having fun, I'll stick to your plan. And we stuck to what the kids were doing, and they really enjoyed it, and their parents were really happy. And at the end, why does my plan have to be the significant plan? Just because I prepared it, all plans change, right?
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
So let's go into some of the responses. I think the first one that you've highlighted probably deserves primary attention. We would like neurodiverse or neurodivergent representation on a task force so that the issues mentioned can be addressed. So from what you're saying, there isn't even any, or up until now, there is no representation on the task force at all.
No. I think the task force is a new initiative, but up until now, like, neurodiversity is still not entirely recognised or represented, and that's what we're really trying to change at the moment for it to be a thing. It's kind of like pigeonholed into a subsect of disability, and I think in doing so, in being so, a lot of people are missed because there are a lot of people who do not consider themselves disabled or disabled in the same way as you might assume, or they feel their disability is transient, or they feel their disability is socially constructed. So I think it's really important for neurodiversity to be a separate category to disability, where you can have neurodivergent people who are disabled by their conditions, or are not, or are disabled in certain circumstances. But to pigeonhole it kind of under disability, I don't think is accurate. And also, on that note, on that note, I feel disability in itself is such a kind of, it's reductive. So
I think probably talking about using like the wrong size Allen kit. I don't think there's a saying.
No, I think there's a saying that's like you're trying to hammer a screw or something. I don't know. It's something like that. But it's like, oh, we'll just chuck everybody into this category, even though there's so much diversity and disability. It's not, to me, it's not right that there's kind of a small, like, disability is one category, and then, you know, there's like one disability representative or even more, but like there's so many different types of disability. I've just gone down a rabbit hole, but
I think that's a part of the same problem. It's a significant question of ignorance, as in people, unfortunately, in positions of influence where they can actually make significant changes to groups of people and communities, they don't actually know anything about those communities for which they are perhaps in charge of making decisions. So a consultation, if it's not representative of the people it's supposed to be serving, then it needs to be thought again.
You'd need representation of amputees, because amputees can't speak to the experiences of somebody with intellectual impairment, who can't speak to the experiences of an autistic person without intellectual impairment, who can't speak to the experiences of someone who's dyslexic. Like, you can't just have one or two or three disability champions, I think.
And I think also here later on, it says a one size fits all approach for disability does not work. You've made that quite clear.
Yeah.
And then later on, so I'm not going to go into all of it, because I think people should read for themselves.
Take long.
But picking out some of the things. So, okay, and one more point, if we could take that then. Sports integrity. You note that many neurodiverse athletes report instances of both bullying and abuse in sporting settings. Now, bullying and abuse, we've heard quite a few high-profile cases in other situations that doesn't relate to disability, but with regards to the abuse of younger people, with the racial abuse, sexist abuse, and so on. So it's extremely easy to believe that this kind of bullying and abuse would also have kind of slipped in under the radar. Nobody's talked about it. And people who may not have yet heard your story should go back and do a search for a lot of the things that you've talked about, so that maybe they can understand exactly how severe some of the issues that you had to deal with were, and the lack of understanding that you encountered for so many years. But how prevalent is it, do you think, still today, even though examples such as yourself have been so vocal in the last few months?
It's still really prevalent, because there are still a lot of people who, you know, are very set in their ways in terms of preconceptions and stereotypes. And unfortunately, there'll be a lot of people who hear my story and just think, oh, some weird autistic, or it's her problem, or she's emotional, or maybe don't even see it in themselves. Like, don't see, you know, they might be like, that's wrong, but I don't do that. And actually they do. So I think, yeah, and I've seen examples of some sports, for instance, gymnastics. They obviously had the white review, which was really damning. But off the back of that, they've had a real big inclusion and wellbeing drive, and they've kind of got some really good people in to lead that. And so they're definitely going in the right direction, because obviously a lot of gymnasts are also young. And I would argue that there's probably a lot of neurodivergent gymnasts too. And I think that's probably contributed to the kind of things that you heard about in the white review. But, you know, part of being autistic is hypermobility and, you know, that intense focus, and that those things make very good gymnasts. But I've also seen some sports, I won't name which sports, but in kind of response to this neurodiversity drive and these things coming out, almost like kind of bolt down and
sort of run away.
Or diversity wash, or say that they're doing the right things whilst kind of cutting all the fat and kind of, you know, reducing their circle even more and excluding, you know. Their response has been, okay, well, if we get rid of all of the different and difficult people, then we can't mistreat them because they're not there. So I've seen that as well.
Yeah, it's great that you said that, because I'd actually just written down greenwashing, because it kind of suggested to me that this was, you know, organizations, they say, oh, we've set up this task force, we're going to work on making things more accessible to people with varying abilities. And really what they're doing is covering their asses, if you forget the
100,000%. Yeah, totally. It's like, what are you actually doing, though, beyond talking, beyond getting some people in the room who are going to tell you what you want to hear and comply? Like, what are you actually doing? So, yeah, I really agree.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So one more thing, because it's going to connect us exactly or directly to the next point. Mikey, sorry. I mean, we've just run ahead here, but if you know how it is, just jump in whenever you.
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah, okay, cool. I'm fine for this moment. Yeah.
Okay. All right. But it's with the diagnosis issue, because you say you've noted the number of people with neurodiversity being diagnosed has greatly increased in recent years. And then at the same time, I sent you this article, which you've probably seen already anyway, but about how ADHD and autism assessment requests have been blocked by the NHS screening system in York and North Yorkshire, this particular pilot that had been launched. And 85% of requests had been rejected, And of the 15% that had been accepted, the people are still waiting for referment to an assessment. And the waiting times are about 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard of people, have it like waiting up to 6 years. Yeah. But
I think like principally, like there's obviously a problem and someone's taken a look at it and tried to find a quick solution, like reduce that waiting list. But the reality is the whole thing needs like an overview, and the whole thing needs looking at how you assess people and how you diagnose people, because you know we don't send people straight to an MRI when they have a bad back. We assess them and kind of see what's appropriate. But sorry, just got a little bit distracted. So it's fine doing an element of screening, but clearly the level of screening is not correct if only 15% of people are getting through, because for starters, I'd almost guarantee more than 15% of the general population have ADHD. Yeah. So,
but also if they're going to the doctors,
yeah,
there's something that they're struggling with. I'm confused and I need to do more research into this, because they've been blocked by the Do It profiler, which is kind of supposed to be a tool for good. And I think it was originally a tool kind of to get people to understand what accommodations they might need in the workplace, not to diagnose them specifically. So I'm really confused as to why that's being used to screen people. Like, and I know the person who created this profiler, and I think her intentions are good. And I actually completed the profiler myself, and I was concerned because it came out saying like I had autistic ADHD and dyspraxic traits, and I was a bit like, oh god, is this going to label everyone as neurodivergent? So then to see it suggesting that people are less, I'm like, how is it being interpreted? Do you need 100, are they, you know, it's how are they using what's coming out? Is it that you need 100% to go through, or is it that if somebody has like 75%, are they being screened out? And so I don't think this is amazing. I don't think it's great. I think there are people that obviously need help, because they wouldn't be going to the doctors if they didn't need help.
I think like they're trying to find a solution to a problem, and obviously if you've only got 15% of the people going through and they're still waiting on a waiting list, then obviously there's more people in the system than it has capacity for. And it is kind of, you know, an ADHD assessment will take, you know, 2 or 3 hours to do yourself, plus then the psychiatrist's time and everything beyond that. So you could, you know, say they can probably actually in reality do 1 or 2 a day. You kind of see why it's the case. So if technology and everything needs to be used to streamline things, that's fine. But the whole diagnosis system needs to be looked at, and if there's more stages, that's fine, but clearly it's not working at the moment, and simply trying to screen people out isn't helpful, because
you know what I would like to think is that on screening people out, they signpost them somewhere to a free app or something, that because there are free apps out there to help people with who maybe have kind of like neurodivergent characteristics, whether they have a diagnosis or not. That would be the ideal. Like if they've got to the end of this test and it said, oh, sorry, you've been, you know, you can't go through to an assessment. What would be responsible is to then say, have you tried looking at this application that might help you with, you know, lifestyle management or something like that? But I'm sure that probably doesn't happen, and they're just given a kind of biffed off.
Yeah.
Which is the concern, isn't it? As in, you know, 85% of people have been turned away. Okay. Then what? Where do they go? Yeah. Who do they speak with?
Yeah.
Because often, like, these people are turning up with mental health conditions, which obviously they're putting down to a neurodiversity. And if you're then just kind of saying no, then what then? It's not really kind of.
And especially, I know it's not ADHD, but when I told you the statistics about autism and, you know, the mortality rate and suicide, like ADHD, unsupported and untreated, can make your life very difficult as well.
Yeah. And I know there was another article a couple of weeks ago about the shortage of ADHD medication. And I remember listening to an expert who said, well, the fact is in this country, we vastly underdiagnose ADHD. The threshold required is actually so high, and a very sort of small section of kind of ADHD, you know, your typical misbehaving boy at school.
If they're a problem to someone else, basically, they get diagnosed. If they're just a problem to themselves, well, they can stay a problem to themselves. Yeah. It's no one else's problem.
So to see, like keep going back to it, see 85% of people turned away, you know, that's not to say that you shouldn't have a screening process, but it's clearly overkill to some extent.
Yeah, that goes back to what I said about I thought the app was good when I tested it, and the results were probably fairly accurate. But I think from my memory, it came up as like, actually, it said like you're maybe like 100% ADHD, 75% autistic, 25% dyspraxic. Whereas I wonder if it had said, you know, you're 75% ADHD, whether that means you're kind of like screened out. Yeah, so it would be how people are reading it. So it's that, you know, you can take the most well-meaning kind of tool and misuse it. And it's also what you said about the threshold being so high.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that the NHS is incredibly underfunded. But if you look at even a little bit in the long term, you know, about how people with undiagnosed, unsupported, untreated ADHD,
like Cara said, you know, about struggle for work sort of thing. So if these people are diagnosed and have a functional treatment plan, then they're far more likely to be productive and
healthy,
add into the system than require support from the system.
It's very short-sighted.
Yeah, and we haven't talked about politics in the past, and I will limit any of my personal opinions with regards to certain policies from certain political parties to another podcast. But this is definitely an issue which I think has to be addressed. But again, it also emphasizes the importance of what you're doing. So obviously you are both sports people, and so that's the area that you know. But any attention that you bring to neurodiversity in sport also filters out to other areas. And I can only imagine that other people are also you know, reading about what you do, listening to your words, and feel heartened by what you're doing. So yeah, long may that continue.
I mean, and I would encourage anyone who has ADHD and maybe doesn't feel like they're being, they're understood or being supported, to either visit our website or Instagram, but more importantly, to, in whatever way they can, participate in some sort of exercise or physical activity, because it is one of the best tools for managing that kind of like lack of dopamine, the wavering attention.
Good. Okay, thanks. We've gone way beyond our normal sort of time frame, but that's fair enough. I enjoyed talking with you, and as you kind of suggested earlier, it's like becoming friends. I'd sit down and I watch you guys argue among yourselves. I find it so amusing. I could quite happily watch this.
They're not real arguments. You'd know if it was a real argument. That rarely happens, but you'd know.
Fair enough. I think the cam would go. It'd be like Blair Witch Project. The cam would go off and there'd be all sorts of quiet. But fair enough. But thank you both. I know how busy you are, and so I appreciate every moment, and all the best. And I obviously look forward to following you guys more and more, and maybe at the beginning of next year we can also have another chat. That would be great.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's good. Thank you.
Great.